From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tracy Tragos and her cousin Andrew Palermo shared happy childhood days in the family hometown, Rich Hill, Missouri, a small former coal town south of Kansas City, way west of St. Louis. They went back to Rich Hill as adults, filmmakers, and were struck by a kind of poverty they did not recall, took their camera and their filmmaking eye and made a heart-rending documentary about three boys growing up in desperate, rural, small-town poverty. It won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. This hour, On Point, Three Boys, Small-Town Poverty in America, and Rich Hill. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you know this kind of small-town rural poverty? Has it changed since our parents' time? And what do you hear in these boys' stories? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later in this hour, we'll go back to Ferguson, Missouri, on the other side of the state, to check in on that town since its uproar over the shooting of Michael Brown. But first, to Rich Hill. With me now from New York is Tracy Droz Tragos. Her grandparents lived in Rich Hill. He, a mailman. She, a beloved third-grade teacher. Tracy's director and producer of the documentary Rich Hill, released last month. It won the Grand Jury Prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Tracy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think we've got your cousin Andrew on the way in California, and I hope he's with us in just a minute. But describe to me your first memories of Rich Hill, Missouri. This is way west, almost out toward Kansas and Oklahoma, south of Kansas City. You went as a child. What are your memories from that time?
My memories from that time are incredibly happy, and a lot of it has to do with my relationship with my grandparents, who were like surrogate parents to me. But, you know, it's like many, many towns across America, small town community. We went to church every Sunday and would shake everybody's hands coming in. My grandfather was also a greeter in the Methodist church there. I learned how to fish, and we would catch grasshoppers by the propane tank and put them in my grandmother's pantyhose, and I'd shoot a BB gun and, learned how to drive much younger than I probably should have on the gravel roads. So it was all pretty idyllic.
When you went back, had Rich Hill changed, or was it just your perspective had changed? You take us into some really grinding poverty here. Was there more of that? Is that why you decided to seek out these three boys who live in it?
Over the years, I felt that there was an increase in poverty. It was never a wealthy town. It used to be a coal mining community, and shortly after World War II, the mines went dry. And so it was never a wealthy community, but there were jobs and there were businesses in the center of town, and I remember when those businesses were open. But over the years, those businesses shut down. And there were more and more houses that had, you know, the tarps on the roof and the broken windows that didn't get fixed. And, for me, it was a source of sadness and also, a deep need to understand what was happening for those families and what their experience was, because I felt like their voices were not being heard at all.
This is such an intimate and compassionate, respectful telling of the lives of these three young men, boys, really. Tracy, stand by in New York, in Culver City, California now. Your cousin, Andrew Droz Palermo, joins us, collaborator, cameraman, cinematographer on the prize-winning Rich Hill. Andrew, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Sorry I'm late.
No, it's all right. Tracy was just describing kind of idyllic childhood days in Rich Hill, where grandparents lived. Your first cousins, when you went back, something grabbed your attention about poverty that drew you to the stories of these three boys. What was it in your case, Andrew?
Well, I mean, for Tracy and I, we had different experiences. She saw it in a different light at one time, whereas, going there when I was a child, it was always the way it is now, which is what she was describing with the tarps and the windows. And, I always wondered how people lived in these homes. And Tracy and I were fortunate that we had a grandmother and a grandfather that both were employed and were middle class. But and Rich Hill that made them sort of the upper crust of the town. And I was always very curious about the other side.
We've got brand new poverty numbers out just today, just this morning, from the U.S. Census Bureau, showing that the poverty rate in the United States has dropped for the first time since 2006. This was for 2013, down from 15% down to 14.5%. But that's still plenty. That's still 45-plus million people living in poverty. Our eye goes to Ferguson, Missouri, because we've heard a lot about it lately, where the poverty level from the latest statistics I have, which is 2009, is 20.9%, almost 21%. And then we look across the state to Rich Hill, this small, much whiter, more rural, much smaller town, only just over 1,000 people there, and the poverty rate 31.3%. That's pretty darn high. That's more than double the national poverty rate. Tracy, I guess you're describing a town where you see that, just coming into town, just walking down the street.
For sure, you see it. And it's not even that Rich Hill is so exceptional in its poverty. It's very, very average, and it wouldn't necessarily look worse than many other places across America. But yes, you can see that people are living in homes that are in disrepair. People are living clearly below the poverty line.
I mean, when I see the homes where your three young men, three boys live, Andrew, Harley, Apache, this looks to me like this is really out on the edge. These are homes that looks like probably people are transient there. They're in bad shape. I mean, they look... From some angles, it's just downright threadbare and squalid. How did the boys see their own circumstances? Did they feel that they were, Tracy, on the edge of Rich Hill society?
Well, I mean, I think there is a certain shame in circumstances, and you don't want to broadcast that that your family may be struggling. I mean, at the same time, there is so much love, and I think that's one thing that struck us in the making of this film, is that there are resources in these families, and there is hope, and there is potential. And so, yes, you know, the windows may be broken, and the refrigerator might be bare, but, you know, they're also living in a kind of beautiful rural place that has, that has a lot of wonderful things going for it. So at the same time, you know, it's a strange tension. But I think the kids also see what they have going for them as much as they know they have a lot of strikes against them.
You capture so wonderfully the beauty and love, even in these circumstances, amid the poverty and despair. Here's a little bit from early in the movie, Rich Hill, the documentary. Prize winner at Sundance, where Andrew, one of three boys profiled, 13 years old when the film begins, is talking about how better off folks in town look at families like his, and he stands up for his folks.
People around town, they walk towards us or walk past us with their nose 50 miles in the air, acting like their don't stink, and acting like they're better than us. And I don't fall for that. We're not trash. We're good people.
We're not trash. We're good people. Andrew, could you describe these three boys for us?
Absolutely, yeah. Andrew, the boy you just heard, is just an amazing, amazing kid. He's so positive and so outwardly loves his family. He sort of lives in this, almost in an American dream in some ways, that, you know, that what people once would have thought of. You know, he plays football. His sister's a cheerleader. And he has two loving parents. He's just a really great kid. And Apache is another one. He's an artistic guy. He's really, really struggling at school. He has some anger problems. But just, you know, a really soulful boy, wise beyond his years. And then there's Harley, who's kind of the gregarious wisecracker. You know, you never enter a room as a stranger to Harley. You know, he wants to come and make you laugh and joke with you, and unfortunately Harley's mother is in prison, and he lives with his grandmother and a lot of his extended family.
There's a very moving story behind that as well. Here's a little bit from Apache, a very smart kid, another 13 years old, kind of a pistol, bundle of energy, reflecting on his home life.
My dad left when I was six. Just walked out. Didn't even say bye. I woke up in the middle of the night and he was gone. And never came back.
Tracy, it just tears at your heart when you see these boys at just the age you've captured them, where they still have some of the innocence of youth, and certainly they still want to be hopeful, and yet they're just at the moment where they're becoming aware of everything that's stacked against them.
Yeah, I mean, just like so many kids, they have dreams and aspirations, and at some point it becomes clear that their roadmap on how to get there is fraught with inequality, is basically what I would say. It's not an equal playing field. And for these families, when they experience a hardship or a misstep, it can be devastating and derailing. And the impact of those times is really what was striking for me to see and experience in the making of this film.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Sundance Film Festival prize-winning documentary, Rich Hill, about three boys in hard times in small-town America, the stream of America that is white, rural, and poor, cut off, cut out. The filmmakers Tracy Droz-Tragos and her cousin Andrew Droz-Palermo are with us from New York and Culver City, California. Three boys, Andrew, Apache, Harley, different characters, just 13, 14, just beginning to really understand how up against it they may be. Andrew's father, Willie, can't hold down a job, keeps chasing jobs from town to town. How much is that because the good jobs aren't there, because the father won't make do with the opportunities there is hard to know, but all the moves have been a huge obstacle in Andrew's life.
We lived in Rich Hill, then we moved to Branson, then to Ridgedale, back to Rich Hill, then to Belton, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Then moved again from Belton to Granby. And
get my
foot. I know. And then from Granby to Raymore, then to Lathrop, then back to Raymore, and then to Appleton City, back here, mm-hmm. Then moved again, well, in the same town, but yeah.
Moving and moving and moving. And there in Rich Hill, God bless the child that's got his own, they say. But these kids just don't. Here's a point at which they've moved again in the film, Andrew, talking about what it's like not to have their own, period.
My dad, he's having troubles making money. We're living with my cousins. We have clothes on our back, we have food in our stomach, but we don't have a roof over our head. It ain't ours. It ain't ours to do what we want with.
Andrew from the documentary Rich Hill. And here's Apache, who looks around the United States, his country, America, and just cannot see how he's going to make it. Things are just too rough, too threadbare. Here's a little bit of his dream.
I was thinking about moving to China. Thinking about moving to China and becoming an art teacher. Because paintings and stuff from China are freaking awesome. I get to sit there and draw dragons all day.
Young, poor American thinking about moving to China to make it work. Tracy Droz-Tragos and Andrew Droz-Palermo are with us. Harry's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Harry, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I just, I was, lived in Rich Hill, Missouri. My father was a telegrapher for the Missouri Pacific Railroad after I was born in 1949, and we lived there for a brief period of time in the early 50s, 51 or 52.
Yeah.
And then we moved as a family to central Kansas to a town of about 2,000, and I stayed there for the next 50 years, moving to Madison in 2011.
Okay.
But I raised my family there, and I watched basically the degradation and the same thing that's happening or has happened to Rich Hill is happening to rural towns all over America. And I see it as part of it is the kind of agriculture that these communities depend on doesn't need the people anymore. It all depends on scale. None of the processing or handling downstream things are located in these little communities that provided the good employment. And once you gut a town of its economic base, you know, what gave people something to do every morning and to raise their families, there's nothing left, really. And you see the things, the last thing that was done in our town was in central Kansas was they built a larger jail. And they weren't jailing alien people from other places. These were their own people. And it's just indicative of what happens when you pull the base out from under people and transportation, and no longer can you get a bus anywhere, or, you know, there's no infrastructure to give these people a means of basically having economic activity to grow these, you know, towns and have some prosperity inside of the little community.
Harry, I'm so glad you've called. It's so sad to see it, isn't it? I grew up in this territory as well, and I spent some time in small towns just the size of Rich Hill, where at that time these were intact towns with full diverse economies and civic lives. And I've been back to see so much civic life stripped away, so much more poverty, echoes of Rich Hill. It's very sad to see.
You know, yes, it is. And you know, my own children grew up 18 years in these schools as soon as they could. And we sent them to the University of Kansas, mm-hmm. They were gone. And now they all live in Madison, Wisconsin, where they have futures. There's a viable job market, and they can, you know, something's going on. And there's no reason that can't exist at a lower level in places of 2,000, 3,000 people. We just don't enable it anymore.
Not easy to enable. My family was lucky enough to have a farm. Tracy, Andrew, you show in Rich Hill, I think it's a 4th of July celebration where everybody comes out and there are floats and parades and guys and gals on horseback. It's clear that not everybody in this town is threadbare. There are levels even here, Tracy.
Yes, and a lot of it is tied to farming. Families who have had farms in their families for generations.
Yeah.
And so the young kids can, you know, inherit these farms, although even there, they're struggling because they're being pushed out by factory farms and, you know, they need to do bigger and bigger and more, and you really can't get by just on a small family farm. You know, one thing that that struck me by this call also is the is the notion that there are a lot of new people that are somehow drawn to these communities, new families that are really vulnerable and low income, because it is a cheap place to live. Because increasingly so, the rents are really, really low, and you can easily live there on very little. However, then you're stuck. And just as you see, you know, there's no transportation, there are no jobs there. So what do you do when you are there, especially if you don't have a car yourself or you don't have money for gas? The sting of isolation with rural poverty is really distinct and different from its urban counterpart.
Squalor and desperation can come pretty fast, but you listen to these people respectfully and patiently as you did. Apache, I mean, they're all smart kids. Apache may be a particularly smart kid, and his mom as well. Big woman in troubled circumstances, but clearly a very intelligent woman. Listen to her talk from Rich Hill about her choices and how her life got shaped so early and with such finality.
I never got to have any dreams or ideals about my life. I turned 17, moved out of my mom's house, started working, met Jeremy, and got married. I never had a life. I never had any dreams or hopes. It just went straight from being in mama's house to being a mother. I didn't get any time in between, which I don't really regret it. I don't regret having my kids. Sometimes I wish I would have had time to grow up a little bit more instead of just being thrown from being 17 to boom, you're an adult now. But I made it. Not always made the right choices, but... and made it.
I made it, but she has found herself in very hard, small-town America circumstances without an economy to back her up. Here's Willie. This is Andrew's father. He's just had a good stretch at this point in the film, able to catch up on a few bills. Summer's coming. He's ready to look ahead to Christmas.
It feels good to have all the bills paid for once. Caught up, pretty much. But I hate money, so this summer is going to be a whole new ball game. It'll be lots of work. Get the kids some things they might want for once. I like to take a day and take the kids down to Walmart or the dollar store and just let them buy whatever they want in a reasonable amount. About $400 a piece worth of stuff. They'll love that.
Take them down to the dollar store or Walmart and give them quite a day. Mary in Winchester, New Hampshire. Mary, thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm so pleased that this is being covered on the show today. I just want the producers to know that I'm incredibly moved by this film. We started at the Monadnock Film Festival up here in Keene, New Hampshire, and it is just one of the most authentic and respectful pieces that I've seen around this issue of poverty. And my point, I don't really have a question, but I think what's most important and resonates for me, excuse me, is how it debunks many of the myths that we carry in our U.S. culture about those who live in poverty.
Yes.
And particularly this one that I hear a lot called the culture of poverty. And I think we really need to stop using that terminology. Particularly I hear it in teacher education where my profession lies. So I just really want to, again, accolades, and I'm planning on using this. I'm actually off to teach in a few minutes. I'm using it with my high school kids and all the teacher education I'm doing, because we need to look at the connections between poverty and education, but also understand that poverty and folks who live in poverty don't choose it. It is not a culture. It is a state of economic duress, and it's part of how our society is unfortunately shaping their lives, but people don't choose that.
Mary, I'm so glad you called. I'm so glad you've seen it and pick up on the deep respect, even as it shows these boys and their families in deeply difficult circumstances. I hope you do use it in teaching. It's powerful. Here's a little bit of Harley. Drawn to knives, maybe a short temper, hot temper, maybe there's a reason for it. Almost out of the blue here in Rich Hill, Harley starts talking about rape, child rape. It's later in the film we find out why, but here he is.
I got strong feelings about rape, too. I don't like it. I'm against it. Because there's some things that have happened to me that I don't really talk about. But they've still happened. I mean, I ain't forgot about them.
Harley in Rich Hill. It turns out that Harley's stepfather had raped him when he was young. When his mother found out, she tried to kill the man, ended up in prison herself. It's a huge hole in Harley's life. He's always calling her, talking with her, writing her letters, growing up without his mother, with his grandmother. She and the filmmakers go to her prison. She wonders why things ended up this way.
It never came out until after I had already been sentenced. The judge sat there and asked me, why did I try to kill my husband? And I told him because my son had been sexually abused. And all he had to say is, I'm sorry about your situation. I don't understand this whole thing. How the state can take a mom away from their kids, but don't do anything to the person who hurt him so bad.
You've got people living with deep sense of injustice, but there they are. Vivian in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Vivian, thank you. You're on the air.
Oh, hello, Tom. I am so grateful for this program. I grew up, I was born in 45. My father left 8 children in 46. California with his new love, no means of support for us. We did have what was then called AFDC, Aid for Families with Dependent Children, in Ozaukee County, Wisconsin. When I was 9, my mother remarried, went to Oconee County, Wisconsin. She married an unsuccessful farmer who was older at the time, and we rented farms and houses.
Mm-hmm.
and moved from place to place. There was no assistance there. There was sort of an attitude of they should have stayed where they were. We had at least a winter, maybe two, surviving on potatoes and powdered milk.
Mm-hmm.
I have to credit my mother with being very creative. She was a strong woman, an ethical woman. I was number seven child, so as we all aged, we got out of the house to feed ourselves. We went to where we could find jobs, and for me it was Green Bay because that was 50 miles from the rural town we were in. But as poor as we were, there were worse-off families. On our bus route, a long bus route to get to a small community school, I remember a family where the cows were just skinny. Their ribs were sticking out. And there was a girl and a boy that got on at that farm. And then after a while, they just weren't there anymore. And I kept thinking years later when I'd see articles on urban poverty, Chicago, New York, ghettos. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, what about rural poverty? When is someone going to recognize rural poverty in these communities where we couldn't drink the milk our cows produced? It had to go. We drank powdered milk. And eventually the farming was unsuccessful, and my stepfather and mother gave it up.
Don't forget about the countryside, Vivian. We've got it. And maybe now more than ever. Andrew, what do you hope people will take away from this film?
Well, I really hope they, they lean into their communities and, like the caller describes this family that she saw. I hope that people don't turn away from that a family like that, and can offer assistance to people like them. And people even within Rich Hill, I think, have really seen their community in a different way, and that's. More than I could have ever hoped for in some ways, people that really wanted to sweep them under the rug, families like ours. And, they really had their mind changed.
It just seems tragic, Tracy, to see these boys fall kind of over into despair. And yet there's every reason why they might. They don't all in this film, though. None of them are up against easy circumstances, but they're up against a lot here.
They are. And these boys specifically have, in some ways, had their circumstances shift because of their participation in this film, which is amazing. They have had the opportunity to experience sharing this film with audiences and experiencing audience reaction.
Yeah.
They feel like they belong in a kind of way that they haven't. And so my hope with this film is that so many kids like Andrew, Harley, and Apache feel like they belong too. That this is their land of opportunity as well, and that their futures matter. That these aren't families that we dismiss and say, they're living off the system or that they're choosing their lot. It people don't choose this.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Sundance Prize-winning documentary, Rich Hill, about three boys in hard times in small-town America, the stream of America that is generally white, rural, and poor, cut off, cut out. The filmmakers Tracy Droz-Tragos and her cousin Andrew Droz-Palermo are with us. And it is quite a film, beautiful in its way, but it takes us into very, very hard circumstances. The lives of Andrew and Harley and Apache. At one point, Apache gets into a scrape at school, ends up in juvenile court. Truly heart-wrenching scene as Apache and his mother sit on a wooden bench in the courthouse and nuzzle and play as they wait for him to get sent off to county juvenile detention school. His mom, Delena, reflects on letting him go.
It's kind of like a prison type procedure. I think it'll be the best thing for him. It's a structured environment. His attitude will definitely change within the first 2 weeks. And they'll keep him till he's ready for society again. I do think it'll be the best thing for him, but it still breaks my heart that he has to go. That's my baby. but I've done everything I can for him.
With the few resources she has, Tracy Andrews Standby, Mary Beth Mattingly joins us from Durham, New Hampshire, Director of Research on Vulnerable Families at the Carsey School at the University of New Hampshire, researcher at the Stanford Center on Poverty and Inequality. She's done a lot of field research, urban and rural. Beth Mattingly, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What did you think of this take on this window on rural, small-town poverty in this country?
You know, I really appreciated the deep insight we got into the lives of these three different boys, and thought the filmmakers did a really remarkable job highlighting how some of the problems got compounded by poverty, so that had the families had more resources, some of the things going on for the boys wouldn't have escalated and become so big. I think some of this discussion from earlier really highlighting the challenges in rural America, that these are really communities that are now struggling, where work has largely disappeared, be it due to changes in agriculture or declines in extractive industries or declines in manufacturing, and trying to figure out how to help families and support families in such challenges.
We've got callers and people writing online saying, you know, the rural poverty is nothing new, and that is quite true. On the other hand, at this show, we have a lot of, among many kinds of listeners, we have long-distance truck drivers. We did a roundtable with them a couple of years ago when the recession was on, and they reported their very vivid images of going into small towns that had been pretty healthy and were no longer so. The kind of tarp over the roof situation that Tracy and Andrew describe. Has it become worse in recent years, this small town problem, Beth?
I think so, absolutely. I think that to think of rural poverty or urban poverty as one concrete thing is a bit misleading. There are several different types of places across rural America, and each of them has a different flavor. And some of the chronically poor rural places that we visit have had generational poverty, and people have really been struggling for generations. Then there are other places that were hit more recently, certainly before the recent recession, but places like the truck drivers described, and places like Rich Hill, where, you know, I was intrigued by the schools. The school, from the brief glances I got, mm-hmm. looked like a pretty good school. The teachers were able to teach in the classroom. The principal was sitting down with Harley, trying yep. to get him to stay. The school was clean. The school looked like a safe place to go. And that's something that a lot of the chronically poor rural places don't even have.
John in Tulsa, Oklahoma is calling. John, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My kids go to a rural school district. They're, it's a grade school. And 78% of our kids in that school district qualify either for free or reduced lunches. Mm-hmm. And when they don't come to school due to the weather, due to summer, you wonder which kids are not eating that day. They all get a free breakfast, but lunches are provided at costs or less. And you sit there and you look at the skinny kids in school. Well, are they skinny by genetics? Are they skinny because they're athletic? Or are they missing? You know, thankfully, my kids don't. But that's always something whenever I'm looking at the kids at pickup time at the end of school.
And there's plenty of it. It must leave you sympathetic to the stories of these three boys in Rich Hill, John.
Absolutely. Yeah, it always breaks my heart to think that the kids are missing out. And then, again, it's not because parents aren't working. A lot of times parents have to work at Walmart or someplace that doesn't pay a good wage. They are trying to get ahead. Sometimes they're working two jobs.
John, I appreciate your call from Tulsa. Beth Mattingly, is this a challenge that we can deal with government programs, free lunches? Do we have to fix the economy and get jobs pushed back down to this level, industry down to this level, to repair this?
I think fixing this is going to take a multi-pronged solution. So absolutely, government programs are part of the answer. Jobs are part of the answer. Looking at a variety of opportunities and options for families.
Andrew, who's kind of the sweetest of the three boys, always an optimistic outlook, even though his mother's got terrible problems, dies in the course of the filming. But he's a good soul, looks after his bedridden mother for a long time, stands by his father with his impractical dreams of becoming a Hank Williams impersonator, is devoted to his little sister. But even he, the bright spark here, finds himself asking himself why, despite his faith, he says, God doesn't cut him a break. And here's how Andrew, young Andrew in Rich Hill, explains it.
This is what goes through my mind. God has to be busy with everyone else. Eventually, he will come into my life. I hope it happens. It's going to break my heart if it don't.
God has to be busy with everyone else. Eventually, he'll come into my life. It's going to break my heart if he don't. Doesn't there. Andrew, Tracy, catch us up. You say that these boys, are they doing better now? Are they out of detention centers? Tracy, what's the story?
Well, yes. Apache is out of a facility, and he's now started the seventh grade and doing quite well. He is a very, very smart kid.
Yeah.
And one thing that really proud of is the way that his mother has participated in bringing out this film and sharing it with audiences, and the way that she reflects on her life. And she now says that if she doesn't have hopes and dreams, her kids won't either. So that has shifted for her, and she's still a young woman. She's in her 30s. So I think about her, and I'm proud that perhaps we've shifted something in her life as well. We always hoped that audiences would have a measure of empathy for the kids that would then radiate and extend out to the parents as well, because the parents often really are the ones that are just cast aside and dismissed as folks who are living off the system or something.
Harley's mom still in prison?
Harley's mom is still in prison. Unfortunately, we had hoped that perhaps she went before the parole board in July, and we thought she might get out this November, but she recently learned that she will not be released until November 2017.
And Andrew, is his family still moving? We heard that list of towns they've lived in.
Yes. Well, for now, he is in Montana, and he's living with his girlfriend's family while his father continues to move a bit looking for work.
We wish the best to all three of these boys, young men. It reminds us we cannot write people off in this country. We cannot write whole sectors off, wherever they may be. Tracy Droz-Tragos and Andrew Droz-Palermo created Rich Hill, the prize-winning documentary, the Sundance Film Festival. Tracy and Andrew, thank you so much to you both. I'm so glad you went back to Rich Hill and brought this out. Tracy, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And Andrew, thank you very much for your work here.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Beth Mattingly, Durham, New Hampshire, the University of New Hampshire, the Carsey School there. Beth, thank you for your time and insights today.
Thanks, Tom.
In a moment, we go back to Ferguson, Missouri, to check in on that town since its summer troubles, the shooting of Michael Brown and the protest and police crackdown that followed. This is On Point. It has been just over a month since Michael Brown was shot dead in a town most of us had not heard of before, Ferguson, Missouri, the now famous inner suburb of St. Louis. The shooting blew open long simmering tensions between the residents of Michael's town and their local government and police department, and exposed the country to deeper problems that many communities across this nation face. So has Ferguson, Missouri, started to mend, to repair and set things right? Joining me from St. Louis County is Patricia Bynes, Democratic committee woman of Ferguson Township. She joined us when things were really tough there, kind of wild. Patricia Bynes, thank you for coming on again today. Thank you for coming back.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So what's going on in Ferguson since all those wild nights that we saw? Has the town begun to come to terms with the tensions that put all that into the streets, Patricia?
Well, it's not in the streets. Clearly the rioting, the looting, and the huge protests, they have simmered down some. But what has happened, we've since had the first Ferguson City Council meeting since the shooting, and that was a very emotional ordeal. It was a 3-hour meeting, and most of it was made with public comments. And it gave the community an opportunity to vent. The council was not answering any questions, and there was a lot of venting that went on. I would say that you know, the council and the mayor, they had to come take their medicine at some point in time. But I also noticed a diverse crowd. And, you know, everyone that came to the meeting, they were listening. And it was very, it put a face to a lot of the pain and anger that you saw out in the streets, people giving their personal stories about police brutality and excessive force and the courts that have come, and the issue with the municipal courts that have since come out since this has happened. So now we're at the point of really digging deep within ourselves and figuring out how, as a community, do we want to move forward. And as committee woman, I'm focusing on education because I've noticed that a lot of people do not understand how municipal government works. We're beyond voter education where you tell people the forms of ID to show up with. They need to understand why voting is important and how these offices work and how these positions are supposed to work for them. So every Thursday, I've been working on just a basic education of what is a council person, what are their duties, what does the mayor do, talking about the city charter, what does the city manager do, you know, how the chief reports to that, just some very basic education that's lacking.
Committeewoman Bynes, what were some of the issues with the courts and how they were operating that came out in that meeting and beyond that had raised temperatures, tensions?
Wow. So, and this is a St. Louis County problem. Mm-hmm. We have 90 municipalities, which are basically 90 different neighborhoods that many of them have their own police force. There are about 80-something of them have their own policing, which also have their own court system. And because there are so many of them, what tends to happen is the feeling that they prey on the residents that are there for revenue. So there's excessive ticketing. There's racial profiling that takes place. And the fines, the huge amount of fines that are placed on people, they're being asked to pay fines that are way more than their monthly income. If they cannot pay these fines, oftentimes they're put in jail. And even when someone says, I don't have a job or I can't afford this, they're put in jail. So then they lose their job. It's hard to apply for a job when you may have been evicted because you can't make the rent. So there's a real cycle of poverty that takes place once you become involved in the municipal court system here in St. Louis County. So it's not just Ferguson, but reports have since come out. There's a great white paper by a nonprofit called Arch City Defenders, and they have talked about the racial profiling, the statistics, and have documented a lot of the problems with racial profiling in St. Louis County and how the city of Ferguson is one of the biggest offenders.
We've read about how those fines have become a very important part of the revenue stream for many communities. Are there changes in the works so that people would not end up as kind of, you know, in indentured servitude to court fines all over the place?
Absolutely. There was a ordinance proposed, but it came from the council itself. One of the outcries at the city council meeting was, you know, as a community, you have not asked for our input from this. So there are residents who are organizing to give their input on what they think the reforms should be. Currently, under the current system right now in 2013, these fines was the second highest form of revenue for the city, doing over $2 million. That's a lot of money, and that's a lot of people who are in this court system.
Patricia, where does the Michael Brown case stand at this point, the investigation?
Yes, yes. Well, hopefully everyone is aware that the Department of Justice is looking. First, they're investigating the Ferguson Police Department. They're also taking a look at St. Louis County Police Department, and that the FBI does have its own investigation going into the Michael Brown case. We got news yesterday that the grand jury, which was expected to convene in October with a word of indictment or not, is now being pushed back to January. So I know there's a lot of evidence that needs to be looked at, and this needs to be a thorough and fair process. There should not be a rush on convening this grand jury, but many in the community are angry because they want answers, and it's another part of education of having to explain to them what is taking so long. It's my understanding that they really haven't even gotten to the witnesses yet. It's been a while.
This young man's death was tragic, and there was more so much more trouble that the whole country watched. How are you looking at the explosion in Ferguson this summer from this distance of just a few weeks now? Could this end up being a net positive in the way it opened things up, or was it just sad?
You know what? I live here. I love my community. This is positive. It's opened up the door to some conversations that are long overdue. We need to talk about racism. We need to talk about the culture of law enforcement. We need to have a serious conversation about community policing. And we need to talk about moving our community forward and how can everyone do that. And a conversation that is being had right now is we have to show up in our political system. We have to vote and we have to be at the table.
Patricia Bynes, committeewoman in Ferguson Township there in Missouri, I appreciate your time today. We will come back and check in more depth on how things unfold in Ferguson. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.